I'm very gratified that you're doing a program on the six C's because, well, we had a little gathering before earlier today, and a group of students, 15 or 20 students, and I asked them the question of how much was taught to them in high school about the 60s, and the answer was close to nothing. And so I think it's a very important thing that's being done. It's an interesting question as to one, why the 60s is being shunted aside on the one hand, or when it's not shunted aside, that is when it's dealt with, why is it distorted? That is, why is the picture that's given to us of the 60s, and this is a picture I get when occasionally I see something about the 60s or see a reference to the 60s, the picture I get of the 60s is drug-crazed kids racing through the streets, throwing stones and breaking windows. That's the 60s. Well, it's not the 60s I knew. It's not the 60s most people who were involved in the 60s knew. But there's a kind of hysteria that has developed about the 60s and about what the 60s have wrought in American society, because there's no doubt the 60s had a very serious effect on American society. And the question is, what has that effect been? And there are people who don't like that effect, who think that the 60s ruined everything. No, and I mean, here's Hilton Kramer. Don't ask me who Hilton Kramer is. I like to pick out names, you know. I made it up, okay? He's actually an art critic who was writing in the New York Times and very angry about the 60s. He was talking about the National Endowment for the Humanities, you know, getting angrier and angrier. And said, our woeful decline in literary and academic standards is in the context of the more general assault on mind and intelligence as a result of the radical social and political movements of the 60s. Well, here's George Will. Maybe you've heard of George Will. No? Yeah, well, I never heard of George. Well, yes, I confess I must. He talks about how all this argument that's going on about curriculum, what should be taught, should we have multicultural studies, should we have unicultural studies, should we have black studies, should we have only white studies? What kind of a curriculum, he says, these disagreements over curriculum are related battles in a single war, a war of aggression against the Western political tradition. I mean, those are scary terms. When you have a war of aggression, you mobilize armies. And this is a war of aggression against the Western political tradition. And Alan Bloom. How many people here have heard of Alan Bloom? Yeah. So he does exist. I didn't make him up. He actually, about, I don't know, 10 years or so ago, wrote a bestseller called The Closing of the American Mind. He was furious about the 60s. He was just in a state of hysteria about the 60s. The 60s frightened him. I mean, here he was teaching his little seminar at Cornell. When I say little, I'm not trying to demean it by, you know, saying it wasn't an important seminar. No, I mean, there were just a few people in it. May have been a very important, it was about Plato and Aristotle. He was a political philosopher. And he was absolutely furious that his little seminar on Plato and Aristotle was being disturbed by the crowds of students out on the campus protesting against racism and against the war. Something was happening to civilization, and he didn't like it. He said, the democratization of the university that came out of the 60s led to the collapse of the entire American educational structure. He must be talking about us. I mean, I look around, I say, it's collapsed, right? I mean, and here's another member of the National Association of Scholars, which shouldn't fool you, it's an association. But, well, he says, the barbarians are in our midst. Again, talking about the people who are introducing, as a result of the educational changes of the 60s, people are introducing new things into the curriculum. And, you know, the same Alan Bloom who wrote The Closing of the American Mind was very annoyed that history was being taught in a different way. That people were actually teaching a history in which there was criticism of the development of American civilization. And he says, the American tradition is unambiguous. Now, if it's unambiguous, it means it only has one meaning, and he will tell us what it is. America tells one story, the unbroken, ineluctable progress of freedom and equality. From its first settlers and its political foundings on, there has been no dispute that freedom and equality are the essence of justice for us. Now read that statement to Native Americans, or read that statement to black people, or read that statement to women, or read that statement to working people who are very conscious of the fact that the, you know, development of the United States and development of American society has been a development on the backs of working people. With all the good things that you can say about it. He says, the radicals in the civil rights movement succeeded in promoting a popular conviction that the founding was and the American principles are racist. Well, he objects to the idea that the founding fathers were racist just because they were slave owners. I mean, they were slave owners, but not racists. Or, I mean, is it too much for us to take as Americans to take a very hard look at the founding fathers and simply agree that the founding fathers set up a constitution that legitimized slavery? Can't we accept that? That's hard to take. I remember during the bicentennial celebrations of 1987, when they were celebrating the 200 years after the, you know, the making of the Constitution back in 1787 in Philadelphia, and there was huge amount of, well, you know what happens in bicentennials. People go wild with, adulation of whatever it is they're celebrating, and so the founding fathers became gods, actually, literally. I say literally because at that time Ronald Reagan wrote an essay. It's hard to believe that Ronald Reagan would write an essay, but maybe someone wrote an essay and signed his name, or maybe he looked over someone's shoulder and copied an essay, you know. But Ronald Reagan wrote an essay for a scholarly journal, a Parade magazine. and it was about the Constitution. And in it, I'm sorry, I don't have it with me. I like to carry Ronald Reagan quotes around with me. It's just do my heart good. But in it, Ronald Reagan said, our Constitution was made so perfectly that it could only have been made by the guiding hand of God. And, well, that same year of the celebration of the bicentennial of the making of the Constitution, that same year, there was one public voice that spoke out against the general adulation of the founding fathers, and that was the voice of Thurgood Marshall, Justice of the Supreme Court, the only black member of the Supreme Court, and he made a speech in which he said, sorry, I can't join in the general celebration for a document that established slavery as a legal right of those states that had slavery. He was doing the same thing that had been done back before the Civil War by Frederick Douglass, when Frederick Douglass was asked to give a speech celebrating the 4th of July. Frederick Douglass, you may know, the the former slave who became a great leader, orator, writer of the anti-slavery movement, one of the giant figures of American history. He was asked to give a speech celebrating the 4th of July. And the speech he gave for the 4th of July did not please his listeners. He said, what does your 4th of July mean to us? You know, to you it may mean freedom. To us it means something else. Anyway, there's always hysteria, as I say, about what the 60s have wrought, what they did to our history. There was even a point at which somebody suggested, well, not just somebody, I shouldn't say that, two psychiatrists. No, a psychiatrist and a neurosurgeon, I should get them right. From Harvard, I got that right. This was after the great upheavals in American cities in 1968 that followed the assassination of Martin Luther King. And some of you may remember, you read that after the assassination of King, there were upheavals in cities all over the country in reaction against that. And the police came in, as the police usually come in, and do what the police usually do, you see. And there were people who resisted the police and people who fought back against the police. And these two, this neuropsychiatrist and neurosurgeon from Harvard, wrote a letter to the Journal of the American Medical Association proposing a surgical strategy to prevent protesters from resisting the police. Does this sound strange to you? Nothing is strange. I mean, we live in a strange world. I mean, nothing is outlandish, right? I mean, I read some of these things and I say, no, I'm making this up. No, I'm not making this up. You know, they said that these people who quote, violently resisted police control were suffering from brain dysfunction, a condition they said that could be remedied by psychosurgery. At that time, Ronald Reagan was the governor of California. He immediately seized upon this idea, and he prepared to allocate $1 million to set up a violence reduction center. And in fact, in a California prison, they actually performed 50 such operations using prisoners as guinea pigs. And the prisoners ended up as vegetables. This is one of those lost little episodes in American history, but it's worth recalling just to know what is possible. The question is, why either the hiding of the 60s, the obliteration of that history, or the distortion of the history? Why is it important? That's 30 years ago. That's history. And I suppose the answer is, anytime anybody gets excited about the interpretation of a past event, it's not because of the past event. It's not because they want to straighten out what happened in the past, you know, just for the record. No, that's not why people get excited. People get excited about past events because of the present. Because something is happening in the present, something that they care very much about, and they want a certain picture of a past event because it supports the positions that they take in the present. I mean, why do people get excited about the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima? That's a 50-year history. Why still argue about should the bomb have been dropped? Right? You can't. It's too late to do anything about whether too late to do anything about the people of Hiroshima. So why argue about that? Why such a furious argument? And why, when they set up an exhibit at the Smithsonian, which is going to show the suffering of the Japanese people under the bomb, there's immediate protest, and they remove the parts of the exhibit that show the suffering of the Japanese people and just show the dropping of the bomb as a kind of heroic and necessary act. Why do they do that? Not just because they want to straighten out the record of what happened in 1945, I think, but because they don't want people to get the idea that atomic weapons should be done away with. Because people, right? There's still a powerful need among certain circles of this society and others, a powerful need to hold on to this deadly weaponry and not to let its name be sullied by suggesting that any use of this weapon is an act of genocide. So the hysteria over the 60s has a present motivation. And a clue to what this present motivation is, when you look at just after the 60s end, in 1975, yeah, you may think my mathematics is a little off, but when I think of the 60s, I think of a 20-year period. I think of the 60s as being a period from the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955 to the end of the Vietnam War in 1975. And one of the really remarkable periods of American history. And at the end of this period, there was a kind of soul-searching. If some of these people who were searching really had souls, we'd call it soul-searching. But there was a kind of searching for, you know, what did this mean? And so a Harvard political scientist, I'm picking on Harvard tonight. Shouldn't do that, should I? It will be found out. I mean, I live there. I live in the same town as Harvard. People will learn that I said something bad about Harvard. I will be expelled from the city, right? A Harvard political scientist named Samuel Huntington, who was an advisor to, you know, the White House in the Vietnam era. You can imagine what kind of advice he gave. Wrote a report on what had just transpired in this era of the 60s. He wrote a report for the Trilateral Commission, which is a very high-level, kind of semi-secret outfit that represented the financial and political and military establishment of the United States, Western Europe, and Japan. I must speak about it in hushed tones. It was that kind of a thing. Actually, it was the kind of thing you would see in a James Bond movie. See Goldfinger, you know, get an idea of the Trilateral Commission, you see. Those kind of things. He's writing a report for them. And he's writing about the 60s, and he calls his report The Democratic Distemper. That's an interesting distemper. Isn't that bad? Isn't distemper bad? The Democratic Distemper. What does he mean? Here's what he means. The essence of the democratic surge of the 1960s was a general challenge to existing systems of authority. In one form or another, this challenge manifested itself in the family, the university, business, public associations, politics, the government bureaucracy, the military services. People no longer felt the same obligation to obey those whom they had previously considered superior to themselves in age, rank, status, expertise, character, or talents. That sounds good to me. People no longer felt an obligation to obey those who were they had previously considered superior to them. Huntington isn't happy about this. He says, this, quote, produced problems for the governability of democracy in the 1970s. It's interesting, another interesting expression, the governability of democracy. Democracy isn't a phenomenon that comes out of the desire and action of the people. Democracy has to be governed, and he's worried about whether democracy can be governed. He says, the question necessarily arises, if a new threat to security should materialize in the future, a new threat to security. Now, what was the old threat to security? Vietnam. That was a threat to our security. Now, we may have a new threat to our security. If a new threat to security should materialize in the near future, as it inevitably will at some point, the government will possess the authority to command the resources as well as the sacrifices which are necessary to meet that threat. That's what he's worried about. If people, as a result of what happened in the 60s and the movements of the 60s, get the idea that they should not simply be obedient to authority, that they should not simply accept the word of experts, they should not simply accept the word of the President of the United States or the Congress of the United States about what is happening, but they should think for themselves and look for information for themselves, well, that would create a problem. What if we want to have another war? What if they want to have another war? And people are that way. And he said that there had developed, and this is his language, an excess of democracy. Well, exactly what Huntington was worried about, this excess of democracy, to me, has a different meaning. To me, the 60s was a period in which democracy came alive. Because democracy is not simply a structure of government. I remember, growing up and going to junior high school and them talking about, democracy and how they presented democracy. What was democracy? Democracy was our form of government. And what was that? And it was, they put it on the board. They put a diagram on the board, the three branches of government. You must have seen that same, right? The legislative and the executive and the judicial and there's checks and balances and there's division of powers and it was beautiful. And that's democracy. And in that, the system is so beautifully worked out, the checks and balances so intricately designed, so that all you have to do is, go to the polls every 2 or 4 years and vote for somebody who will play an important part in that structure. And besides that, you don't have to do anything. I remember that John Updike, the novelist, let's see, is he also a Harvard man? I'm desperately looking for somebody I can attack who is not a Harvard man. John Updike, the novelist, really a very, very talented novelist. I have to say this before I denounce him. I won't denounce him. I'll just comment slightly. But Updike said that... this was in his memoir. He wrote a memoir some years ago. And he said, I didn't vote. This is a paraphrase because, as I told you, he's a very good writer. I can't match him. I can only paraphrase him in my inelegant way. But this is roughly, you have to take my word for what he said. He said, I didn't vote for Dr. Spock. I didn't vote for Abby Hoffman. I didn't vote for Dan Berrigan. I didn't vote for William Sloan Coffin. I didn't vote for any name, Joan Baez. I didn't vote for any named a bunch of leaders of the anti-war movement. I didn't vote for them. I voted for Lyndon Johnson. And that gave me the right not to make another political decision for the next 4 years. What a crippled view of democracy. Of course, it also tells you something about education, about that is our, a literary mind, and they're the experts, there is Huntington, they're the people with the PhDs, they're the Phi Beta Kappas, they're the best and the brightest. And what do they have to say? He voted for Lyndon Johnson, but he almost forgot, or did he forget, that when he voted for Lyndon Johnson in 1964, Lyndon Johnson pledged that he would not send boys to fight in a land war in Asia. And then Lyndon And so he had fulfilled his obligation by voting for Lyndon Johnson. Then he didn't have to make a decision. And then if the president violated his pledge not to send boys to Asia, and if then huge numbers of people died as a result of the violation of that pledge, then the job of John Updike as a citizen is simply to sit back and wait for the next election while the deaths still go on in Vietnam of Americans and of Vietnamese. Well, what happened in the 60s, as I say, you know, democracy came alive. People realized that the structure of government that had been laid out on the blackboard was really not sufficient to solve very fundamental problems of injustice. And the first movement to recognize that and to act upon that was the civil rights movement. And it was very clear that the history of black people in this country makes it very clear that Americans cannot depend on the normal structure of government to solve deep problems of injustice. Slavery was not done away with by constitutional means. And it was not even done away with just by President Lincoln issuing an Emancipation Proclamation or Congress passing the 13th Amendment. Slavery was done away with by the growth of an enormous anti-slavery movement in this country, which grew from a handful of people in the 1830s to a national movement in the 1860s and put pressure on Lincoln and put pressure on the Congress to finally bring about an end to slavery, and then to bring about the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. And then, even after that was done, even after those amendments were passed, even after the 14th Amendment seemed to promise equality, equal protection of the laws, no person shall be denied of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, for a powerful weapon against what any state might do to deprive anybody of liberty or equality. And that weapon was put aside by every single national administration. Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal, it didn't matter. Every single national administration from the end of the Civil War to the 1960s simply did not enforce the 14th and 15th Amendments. Every president in that entire almost 100-year period violated his oath of office because he pledged to see to it when he took his oath of office that the laws of the United States, that the Constitution will be faithfully executed. But the 14th Amendment was ignored, and racial segregation was allowed to continue in the South, and violence and murder were allowed to continue, and the federal government looked the other way. The problem of racism and the problem of lynching and the problem of violence and all of that was not simply a Southern problem. It was not simply we had that was the way it was in the South and different in the North. It was a national problem, and the federal government collaborated continually for a long period of time. And none of the existing elements of that structure of government that was so neatly laid out for us on the blackboard of our junior high school classes, none of that sufficed to change this situation until black people themselves in the South, in the toughest place, in the worst places, in the most dangerous places, in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and Louisiana, South Carolina, when black people in that most dangerous of situations rose up and created an enormous movement, a movement that swept the country, a movement that then was heard about and seen on television screens and heard on radios all over the world, and that embarrassed the government of the United States and finally began to bring about some changes in how the federal government was reacting to segregation and racial violence in the South. Now, that was democracy. When people were getting arrested, when people were demonstrating, when people were facing the fire hoses in Birmingham, when in the year 1963, 13,000 people were arrested in the first 10 weeks, when in the whole year of 1963, demonstrations took place in 800 American cities. Only then did things begin to stir in Washington. Only then did a Civil Rights Act of 1964 get put up first on the agenda. But that was democracy in action. That was one of the things that was learned as a result of the Civil Rights Movement. What is democracy, and what is government about? And what is law about? And is it true that we must always obey the law? Does the law always give us justice? And the answer was clearly no. The law does not always give us justice. The laws themselves may be unjust, or we may have a law on the books which purports to give us justice, and the law will be ignored. And therefore, justice can only be achieved when people act as citizens, and when they fulfill democracy with their bodies, when they go to jail, when they take risks, when they get beaten, when they make sacrifices, when they break the law. Civil disobedience became an important issue in the Civil Rights Movement. And of course, Martin Luther King Jr. gave that phrase, civil disobedience, a new and powerful meaning by pointing out the difference between law and justice. The great learning that took place in the 60s. I was teaching my first teaching job, Spelman College, a black women's college in the South, teaching there from 1956 to 1963, becoming involved in the movement. People learned a lot about government and about politics and about democracy and about the limits of what they called the channels. You know, whenever you have a grievance, people say, go through channels. You must go through the proper channels. And what people learn when they have a deep grievance is that these channels which are offered to us are very often not channels, but mazes into which we are invited to get lost. And so people go outside those channels, and then they begin to act and to do something. And one of the other things that came out of the Civil Rights Movement, one of the other learning experiences of the Civil Rights Movement, was simply about education itself, about what was being taught. What was being taught about the history of black people in this country? How many people in this country knew about the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendment or about the Reconstruction period? They were still teaching about the Reconstruction period after the Civil War, well, in the way that some people want to teach about the 60s. Oh, a terrible period. Black people were sitting in the legislatures in the South. Black people were voting. At Spelman College, a Negro college, as it was called, it's still called, you know, the United Negro College Fund, there was no course in black history. No course in Negro history. Not one. There was a required one-year course in English history, the history of England. I remember the first day I walked into a classroom, my first day teaching at Spelman College, I walked into the classroom, and there on the blackboard was something left over from a previous class, and it was a chart of the dynasty of the Tudors and the Stuarts. Have you ever seen such a chart? It's fascinating. There is James I. There is James II. There is Charles I. There is Charles II. There is Edward. There, and so on. It's great. Does a lot for you. No course in black. It was an interesting lesson in the relationship in education and action, because very often people thought, well, if we're going to bring about social change, what we do have to do is educate people. And if we educate people enough, we'll bring about social change. Well, it actually works mostly the other way around. You create a movement for social change, and you begin to educate people. And not only do you begin to create education in the vortex of the movement itself, which is an education, but then the people, as my students did, they left the classroom, went out to sit in and get arrested, came back to the classroom, and then asked, where can we read W.E.B. Du Bois? You know, I mean, that's the way things work. People get involved in something, and then they want to learn about it. But as you know, this is a terrible thing. As a result of the movements of the 60s, the women's movement and the Native American, people wanted to learn about Native American history and women's history and black history and what's happened to our educational system. One of the things I learned, just by being there and being a kind of participant, writer, I was on the executive committee of SNCC, which is a short name for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. One of the things I learned from is that silence does not mean consent. The people came into the South in the late 1950s, and it was possible for them to look at the black population of the South and say, hey, you know, there's not a lot going on here. Remember, the sit-ins of 1960 came by a surprise. The freedom rides of that whole movement came as a sort of explosion on the scene, surprised. Now, it's true they didn't come out of nothing. There were things that happened before. There were roots to those things, and there were organizations in the black community, and there was the Highlander School, and there were the black churches, but on the surface, what you saw was silence. And that silence was very often taken as consent, and people would say, oh, you see, black people are happy here, right? You know, you don't see them making a commotion, do you? Well, that was yesterday. Today they're making a commotion, suddenly. Silence, I say that because it's important today. It's important not to mistake the silence of Americans today for acceptance of whatever goes on in our society. Because very often people understand what is going on. They know something is wrong. They know something is wrong with the political system. They know something is wrong with the economic system, and they are silent because they don't yet know what to do about it, and because they're afraid that if they do something about it, they'll be alone. What happens in social movements is that some people make forays and some people make the first move. And sometimes that first move leads to nothing. And sometimes that first move leads to a second and a third and a fourth. And soon before you know it, you have a movement. It's important to know that when you get discouraged about the possibility of a great new social movement in America to rectify whatever social injustices we have today, unless you think, well, we don't have any social injustices today. Looking at my watch to pretend that I care. One of the things that some of us began to learn in the civil rights movement, and then again in the movement against the war, was to examine the whole notion of professionalism, of what it means to be a professional. You know, do your thing as a professional and not get involved in stuff outside. I mean, I'm a historian, I'm a PhD, I'm a college professor. It's not professional for me to join a picket line or sit in at Richard's department store. It just doesn't look right to my fellow historians or to, you know, who knows who, you know. Will I be expelled from the American Historical Association for this act of indiscretion? People began to re-examine their roles as professionals and historians and anthropologists and lawyers and business people and people in all walks of life began to think, am I supposed to simply duly take my place as a cog in the machinery of society and let the people up there at the top make the decisions without my daily input and daily reaction, make the kind of decisions that kept racial segregation here for a long time, the kind of decisions that got us into Vietnam and caused the deaths of several million people in Southeast Asia? Is it unprofessional for me to recognize that I must not be silent. A lot of people began to learn that. And one of the results is that today there are people in the various professions who are not simply professionals. There are lawyers around the country who are not simply traditional lawyers, but who are handling the cases like Mumia Abu-Jamal in Pennsylvania, handle the cases of people who have been wrongly abused by the police or by the justice system. And there are scholars and there are teachers around the country who are not simply being obedient and doing exactly what the school committee would want them to do, but they're bringing in materials into the classroom and exposing their students to experiences that the students wouldn't otherwise have, and bringing their students out of the classroom sometimes to take a look at what is happening in the world outside. The Vietnam War was a similar learning experience. And one of the immediate things that comes out of that experience is a recognition that you must never think it impossible to achieve something that looks impossible. By that I mean, when the Vietnam War started, well, we don't know exactly when did it start. Let's put it this way. When the United States began its major escalation of the war at the end of 1964 and the beginning of 1965, when it began to send 200,000 troops to Vietnam and began the heavy, incessant bombing of Vietnam, and a handful of people around the country began to protest, it looked pitiful. How are these little bands of protesters going to stop the most powerful country in the world, stop the most powerful military machine in the world from doing whatever it wants to do? But the fact is, that movement grew. In 1965, in the spring of 1965, I was one of the speakers at the first anti-war movement on the Boston Common. Boston Common is a traditional sort of place for meetings and political rallies and so on. Early 1965, Johnson had just started the bombing of North Vietnam, and how many people came to our rally, our anti-war rally? About 100 people. This is in the spring of 65. In the fall of 1969, there was another anti-war rally on the Boston Common. Again, I was one of a number of speakers. 100,000 people were there. The anti-war movement grew and grew and grew until it encompassed millions of people, until the public opinion polls swung completely from one side, where most people said, yes, the war should go on, and the other side, where most people said, no, the war should not go on. And it did that in 3 or 4 years. Movements can grow. That's why the establishment gets excited even at the smallest of acts of dissidence. That's why they rush to, that's why the FBI takes photos and keeps records and takes down names and taps wires. And that's why the police come out when there are just 3 people on a picket line and 12 police come out. Is they know something that very often we forget, that small movements can become big ones. Oh, they don't always, but they can. And that's what happened in the movement against the war in Vietnam. And told you something about people's capacity for moral indignation. Gave you a good feeling about the American people. But when the American people saw, well, it wasn't just that our boys were being killed. Of course, that was an important factor. But when Americans saw on television that our soldiers were setting fire to Vietnamese villages, were rounding up women and children, and in some cases, the most atrocious case being the case of My Lai in early 1968, crowding women and children into a trench and gunning them down and killing 400, 500 people, the My Lai massacre. When people saw things on TV which made us ashamed of what our government was doing in Vietnam, then the American people became aroused, and the movement grew and grew. It was a testament, I think, to the good inclinations of the American people. And sometimes people say to those who are critical of what our country is doing, oh, you're against our country. No, not against our country. The country is a people, against the government, when the government follows policies that are detrimental to our people and to the detriment of people overseas and in other places. And the Vietnam War showed the breadth of this moral indignation extending to groups of people that we didn't expect to join movements, priests and nuns. Do you remember? Priests and nuns. There was a Catholic anti-war movement that developed. You're going to hear later in this program, you're going to hear Father Daniel Berrigan, a Catholic priest, a good friend of mine. We became friends when we both traveled in 1968 to North Vietnam to pick up the first three prisoners of war, American airmen released by the North Vietnamese. But a Catholic anti-war movement developed. Very often that's sort of forgotten. What's also forgotten is that GIs who returned from Vietnam became an important part of the anti-war movement. And very often the peace movement, the anti-war movement, is set against the GIs. Say, oh, the anti-war movement spat on the, you hear these stories, on the soldiers. And I don't know where that started. All I know is nobody I ever saw, knew about, read about, heard about, in the anti-war movement thought that the soldiers were responsible for what was happening in Vietnam. We blame the government. We blame the experts. That's another. And then the anti-war movement was, I think, one of the most important forces. When these guys came back in the 1971, gathered in Washington, they showed up in their wheelchairs and with arms gone and blind and the thousands of them. They gathered in Washington and to protest against the war, to demand that the war stop, and they threw their medals over a great big fence into a great big pile to show how they felt about the war. That part of the anti-war movement has very often been ignored and forgotten about. Not just the Vietnam War, but war, violence, militarism. King felt that way. King felt it was not just the Vietnam War, it was violence and militarism. People began to think about American foreign policy. Some people began to read up on American foreign policy. Oh, was everything beautiful before the Vietnam War? Was our foreign policy wonderful and humanitarian before this terrible Vietnam War? And then they learned about how many times we had intervened militarily in the affairs of Central America and not for humanitarian purposes. For the purposes of the United Fruit Company, or for the purposes of, in Chile, of, you know, Anaconda Copper and AT&T, for the purposes of the Vanderbilt Railroad interests in Central America, for the purposes of the sugar planters and the people who gathered in huge amounts of land in Guatemala and Nicaragua and Honduras and so on, American people began to look at American foreign policy and began to realize, and this was a shocking thing to those of us who have been brought up thinking, well, you know, there are these imperial powers in the world that send their troops here and there. There's the British Empire and the French Empire and the German Empire, but the United States is different. No, the United States, like other great powers, grasping, imperialist, aggressive, and sending troops abroad and doing devastation abroad in the interests of power and profit and geopolitical motives that had nothing to do with humanitarianism. This is a shocking thing to realize, you know, because you don't want to learn that about your own government, but then you realize, no, your government is not the people. Government is not you, and very often the government is following policies that it drags the people into, and people, and then the history is obliterated, and so there's a lot of learning that took place during the Vietnam War about all of this. There's learning about anti-communism. You know, before Before the 60s, you know, the McCarthyism, the Cold War, anything, anti-communism, to defeat communism anywhere, here, there, became the motif of so much of our foreign policy. Why are we engineering a coup in Guatemala in 1954? Are we doing it because the new democratically elected government of Guatemala has seized the lands of the United Fruit Company? Oh, no, that doesn't bother us. Communism. There are communists around in Guatemala. So we're going to overthrow that government and set up a government that we like, a government that will then become one of the most brutal governments in Central America, and it will kill tens of thousands of people. But we learned a lot about all of this as a result, you know, of the Vietnam War. But I think we all know that the 60s was not just an anti-war movement or a civil rights movement or a women's rights movement, or, you know, and that things came out of it, the gay rights movement and a general resistance to authority, but a cultural change, you know, a change in the way people dressed, in the way, when I went to teach at Spelman College, all of us college professors wore ties. This to me is one of the most revolutionary changes. I always hated ties. And you might say, that's why I joined these movements, to get rid of my tie. See? But now there was a change, yes, in ways of thinking and ideas about cooperation and in very existential questions about what is life all about? Are we supposed to plod our way through our careers and become successful? And, you know, the kids who left college, the black young people who left their colleges, Spelman and Morehouse and the Fisk and other colleges and Talladega, that was a very dangerous thing to do. A young black person needed college more than anyone else. And so they were leaving that behind and getting into the movement and getting arrested. But they came to believe that there was nothing more important in life they could do. Years later, when I've attended a number of reunions of people who are involved in the civil rights movement in the South, and in these reunions, people sort of trade stories about what they went through, you know, how reunions are. We'll trade stories about what they went through in those days in the South and what it was like driving along a road in Mississippi at midnight and so on, and really how terrible it was. And then they would say at the end, but those were the best days of our lives. Because people who join social movements find that life is enhanced, life, that they learn more, that they live at a higher level, that they feel better about what they're doing. And nobody is suggesting that everybody must, you know, immediately drop all thought of eating and drinking. And we need to maintain some level of economic security, but that's not enough. No. Tolstoy, the great thinkers and artists sort of recognize that. Tolstoy, you know, at a certain point in his life said, you know, I can't simply write novels. He was writing great novels, you must admit. But he said, I can't simply do this. I must get involved because of the peasants in Russia and the way they're living. James Joyce, in The Portrait of an Artist of a Young Man, said something about Stephen Dedalus is renouncing his orthodox religion, setting off on his own path. He says, I will tell you what I will do and what I will not do. I will not serve that in which I no longer believe, whether it calls itself my home, my fatherland, or my church. And I will try to express myself to some mode of life or art as freely as I can and as wholly as I can. That was a spirit that grew and became important in the 60s about how people should live their lives. And I think it's a spirit that needs to be reawakened today, because today we need a new social movement in this country. We don't have democracy. The political system is can hardly be called democratic. I mean, what is the difference between the Republican and Democratic parties? Yes, there's a difference, I admit. But how much of a difference? And is it the kind of difference that will really bring about the needed changes in this country? It's a difference between a $300 billion war budget and a $265 billion war budget. It's a difference between having a dinner for donors where they pay $400,000 each, as the Republicans demand, or the Democrats, where they only ask for $200,000 each. A corrupt political system, an unjust economic system in which the 1% at the top get richer and richer and richer, and probably one-fourth or more of America's children live in poverty. I mean, you look at the latest report of the Children's Defense Fund in Washington, and, you know, it's very easy to be deceived, and, you know, you hear the president get on television and say, oh, we're doing well, you know, prosperity. Look at the figures. Look at the unemployment figures. Look at the inflation figures. Look at the Dow Jones average. That will tell me how well I'm doing. The Dow Jones average. That's why they have it every night on television, because it's an exact register of how Americans are living. The Dow Jones average has gone up 400% in the last 15 years, and the average wage of working people has gone down 15%. And I don't want to go through a recitation of the fact that here in this richest country in the world, there are still problems that are shameful, because we have the wealth to correct them, and that wealth is being expended in the military budget, and it's being pushed up into the very, very rich 1% of the country that can do whatever it wants. So we need a social movement in this country, and that's why we need, once again, the spirit of the 1960s. Thank you.